You are listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Hello and welcome to the CRM Archaeology Podcast, episode 90 for August 3rd, 2016. I'm your host, Chris Webster. On today's show, we talk about the big picture. Why do companies operate the way they do? And is subcontracting as a 1099 employee the right way to go? All this and more on episode 90. So stop playing Pokemon Go for 5 minutes so you can check out the IRS links in the show notes, because the CRM Archaeology Podcast starts right now. Welcome to the show, everyone. Joining me today are Sonia from Utah.
Good morning.
Steven in Calgary.
Hello.
And Doug in Scotland.
Hey.
All right. So before we start, I just wanted to mention real quick, because not everybody listens all the way to the end through the outro. But I just wanted to mention that we do now have a Reddit page. It's just ArcPodNet. I don't really use Reddit that much, but I know a lot of people do. So if that's a place where you like to go and comment on things and find things, then you can find the CRM Arc podcast and all the other APN shows on Reddit now. I've only got like 6 entries up there because I'm not entering in the past episodes, but I'm entering them in as they show up now. So feel free to go over there and comment and do whatever the heck you do on Reddit. So all right. Also, one of the things I was just telling the co-hosts here is that our 100th episode is on December 21st. So keep an eye out for some stuff I'm going to ask you guys for. I want to find out, some typical things that people do for milestone episodes like this, which is like maybe what's your favorite episode, things like that. And maybe we can talk about it. We got some other ideas for what we're going to do too. So just letting you know that. So, but right now let's keep getting on with episode 90 here. So the first thing we're going to talk about is there was a post in Archaeofield Techs on Facebook, which is providing lots of fodder for our podcast and our discussions, this group is. But there was a post, one of the gentlemen on there posted that he just talked to somebody on a firm, and I don't usually put the names out from Archaeofield Techs because it is a closed group unless they specifically say I can. So if you're a member of that, go over there and you can see this discussion. Anyway, he put out a post that said he talked to an employer that said that they wanted to know if he would accept the job if they paid per diem later, basically. He didn't say how later. It clearly wasn't on a cycle like every 2 weeks or something. It was later. I don't know what later means. But and then he found out that the per diem for that job was $200 a day. That's what they're going to cover, which means that the hotels are probably pretty expensive in that area. That's usually what that indicates. So if he's got to cover his hotels and his food, then that's going to cost, a significant amount of money. And he's saying his presumption was that the company must not have the money to pay him the per diem. And he's kind of made a comment at the end saying, I've heard this before, like, is he going to get paid at all? Blah, 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 blah. So I wanted to talk about that and just kind of bring up some big picture items and maybe give some alternate reasons for why this may be, and maybe some alternate circumstances for you as a field technician or crew chief that, you can maybe operate a little differently when you're thinking about this job. Because let's just get into this then, because, a lot of companies out there, the way they operate is really on a shoestring budget. I mean, we like to think that, these companies, because they own a business, that's like the gold standard in America is to be a business owner. They say, work for yourself. It's the American dream, own a business. But in reality, for a lot of these companies, it really is just living day to day and trying to figure out what's going on, because, your clients, if they're private clients, you've got whatever terms you guys set. But if they're government clients, there are milestones to be paid. There are, different things. Like, I did a $300,000 project last year, and I was a subcontractor. I wasn't even the prime contractor. So I was a subcontractor for a prime contractor to the U.S. government. And there were milestones based on how many acres we completed, how many sites we recorded, when the field work was finished, when the draft report was turned in, and when the final report is turned in. You get a certain percentage paid out to you from that contract. It doesn't all come at once, and it doesn't all come in the beginning either. So the reality is you need to have a lot of money in the bank to cover the expenses, and expenses, the biggest expenses are field work and employees. So you need to have the money to cover that while you're doing this. So my guess is, and I wrote this on the comment too, my guess is this company probably won a contract that was maybe bigger than they expected. Maybe they didn't expect to win it. I don't know. Maybe they just, you know, PIs, they just write proposals left and right, because you're not going to win all of them. You'll win like 10% of them. So you just keep writing proposals and hope for the best. And you figure it out when you win it. Maybe not the best way to do business, but that's what people do. So my guess is, though, that they won this contract. They want to get it finished. They've got a time frame. And they just simply don't have the money. If I had to guess, they're probably trying to get a loan on the back end so they can cover this or something like that. Again, I don't know anything about this company or the situation. I'm just hypothetically speaking here. But, you know, I got to give them props really for accepting the contract and really trying to get some work done. And in the end, they are going to employ some people. They are going to create some jobs and they're going to give people money, but it might not be on the terms that you're happy with. Sonia, I'm interested in your take on this as a fellow small business CRM firm owner. What do you think about this situation?
Yeah, I agree. I agree with you. It's possible that the company is small. It could be that the company's large. It could also have something to do with contracting and the way that, like you were saying about milestones for federal projects. Mm-hmm. Other things are contracts are always written benefiting the client. If it's the client's contract, they're not going to benefit the company at all, the cultural resources firm. They're going to benefit the client only. So it's also possible that the contract that the company signed was basically a reimbursement only, and they actually, the client actually dictated how people were to be paid. I've had that happen before. There are so many different options that clients and companies kind of negotiate, and those things filter down to the employees, which is, you know, it's kind of too bad, but at the same time, there's only so much that the company, the CRM firm, can do. And what I was concerned when I read that post was, okay, there's not a good understanding out there about how business actually works. And we need to work on that. We as business owners need to work on that and get some education going. So, and that's what we're here trying to do. In terms of $200 a day is a lot of per diem. And it is also possible that maybe in this case, you can approach the company, the CRM firm, and say, hey, you know, can you front me 50% of that? There are some negotiation options, and if they say no, absolutely not, it's up to you as to whether or not you want to take the job. You're not a bank. I get that.
Yeah.
But many companies nowadays have had people walk off projects after taking $2,000 in per diem. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've seen that. I've been around long enough to see that. And if you've only worked a day, obviously, who's getting the better end of the deal on that? Mm-hmm. You or the employee or the employer. My company usually will pay for hotel and set that up for you, but per diem is paid after your each pay period essentially. So that's how we operate.
Yeah, and I've heard that the walk off argument before from a number of different people that's why they don't do cash per diem at the beginning of the session anymore. Mm-hmm. My thoughts on that are, and maybe it's a little naive as well. Quite honestly, my thoughts on that are, I've got a pretty small company, and I have the ability to hire very specific people. Like on the project last year, I did have three people at the start of the project that I had never worked with before, but they came highly recommended, as well as the additional people that I took on later on. They also came highly recommended, and I know how small this field is, and not that I would call them out on like my podcast that gets 3,000 to 5,000 listeners a month, but I have a fairly decent sized social media presence as well, and I do often get. I do often get people contacting me saying, hey, have you heard of this person? Have you heard of that person? And I'll tell you what, you do that too many times, and that little $2,000 you just took home, will, will not get you very far if you never work in this industry again. So I hope you spend it wisely and bet it all on black or something, because that's all that's all you're going to get. But that being said, you know, I want to throw out some real world numbers and situations there. I mean, I have a feeling, I don't know this for sure, and I don't think in reality they really thought this, but some of my people last year, you know, I kind of acted like I was a bigger company, you know. I mean, I paid pretty well, not super high, but not low either, but probably the high end of the middle range for California, because that's what the project could afford. You know, the per diem was set by the Navy, so I didn't have any choice in that, and it was decent for where we were working. But I was very adamant about paying cash per diem up front, because I know what it's like to be a field tech. I know that when people come into a season, you know, they're probably low on money, and it really is difficult for them to compensate for that. But I want to talk about that later on too, about different options you have. But anyway, so I was paying cash per diem up front, and by the time I had my second crew, we were looking at close to $10,000 every 2 weeks that I was putting out in per diem. Okay. And I think it was just under $10,000. And then I also had, you know, all their wages. So every 2 weeks they would also get a paycheck. And that was around, you know, $15,000 or so. So, you know, I was outlaying $25,000 every 2 weeks. I don't have that kind of money. I didn't even make that kind of money last year personally. You know, my company did, but I didn't. And the reasons for that are, there's lots and lots of reasons for it. It's not because I'm a bad business owner and make bad decisions. The contract is what the contract was. There were no negotiations on this particular contract, and we had to take it. Now, if you want to message me in the background, I'll tell you why, because I'm not going to get into that here. But we didn't have a choice on taking the project, really, and we had to take it for what the Navy said we had to take it for. Okay, that's just the way this particular arrangement works. And then on the second part of that equation is they pay on milestones, the Navy does. And again, they were paying my prime contractor, which also had their own expenses. So the Navy's paying on milestones. And if I didn't have a prime contractor that was amazing and really, really had not only their interest at heart because it was their project, but my interest at heart too, because I was doing the major portion of that work for them, which is the field work. But and Sonia's got a good point here. She's saying in the background to tell people what milestones are. So milestones, basically, I can't remember exactly where for this project, but let's just say 50% fieldwork completion. That's usually based on acreage. Let's say we had 30,000 acre project. When we finished 15,000 acres, they'll pay 20% of the contract price, or we can invoice them for 20%. And then, you know, let's say full project completion, they'll pay another 20%. And then, you know, turn in the site records, they'll pay another 20, turn in the draft report, they'll pay another 20, and then turn in the final report after comments are received back, and then that's the final 100%. So, and I'll get to that in a second, but basically, you know, I had a $50,000 SBA loan to start that project, because I didn't have the money in the bank. I'd never done a project of that size before with my company, so I didn't have a chance to really build up that kind of cash reserve. So I had to get an SBA loan, which I'm still paying off as well. Although I was able to cover a lot of it with that project. But either way, that helped me on, you know, per diem and payroll. But as you can tell from the numbers I just told you, that didn't last very long. And luckily, I was able to keep invoicing my client every couple of weeks. And they were able to find the money from other projects because they knew they were big enough that they could do that. They knew that the money was coming in from the Navy eventually. So they were able to keep covering my invoices so I could keep paying my employees. But then when the fieldwork ended, that little gravy train ended as well. And since the final report was just turned in a few weeks ago, the draft final report, and we're waiting on comments, and then they'll turn in the final report, and then we'll get the final payment. And then, you know, they still owe me $38K, and I have a $20,000 tax bill to the IRS. So that I still haven't paid because I'm waiting for that money to come in. So, you know, it's not all wine and roses here on the CRM side of things. And I'm not saying I wouldn't do it again, but I would seriously think about doing things a little bit differently. You know, with how I hire my employees, the type of employees I hire, and again, I want to talk about some of those options here, probably in the second segment. But you know, you guys have got some good comments back here. Steven, what's your take on some of this? Because you were, I don't know if you guys hired subcontractors, if you always just directly hired people when you worked in Wisconsin. But what's your take on this?
Well, from past experience, you know, working for different firms, That yeah, sometimes it's not uncommon that they give you the per diem like at the end of the week, as opposed to the beginning of the week. You know, the downsides there is, you know, a strong minority of the crew had trouble keeping it in their wallets over the weekend. you know, for the most part, that was those companies' way of, you know, keeping people from cutting and running. You know, something I should point out here, the company I work for, they, unless the crew is really substantially large, they don't do per diem, or unless it's part of the contract. What they end up doing is they put you up in the housing, and then they also feed you. So there's the, you know, we all go to the restaurant at the end of the day or for lunch. A lot of times it's, you know, whatever you want. We swing by the grocery store at the beginning of the first day, load up the cooler, and then, you know, have a tailgate buffet for lunch. And I got to say that really, compared to what you would be making in per diem, the field techs are almost always coming out ahead. That it's, you know, I've never eaten so well as I do on this job. Because they you know, they don't scrimp on, you know, it's not like Burger King every night. You know, it's like we're going to a reasonable, you know, maybe not steak and lobster every night, but, you know, a reasonable, you know, $20 entree dinner for everybody. And I think, you know, I haven't really looked at the books because that's not really my job, but I suspect that, you know, especially with the tailgate lunches and everything like that, in the long run, it really doesn't cost the company that much more than if they were to do a traditional per diem route. And it is very often much better on the morale front.
Let me comment on that real quick. Because again, I don't know how this company is operating in the books either. But I mean, you know, whatever they're doing, they're doing it. And this is not a disparaging remark. It's just business. But they're doing it because it benefits them more than doing it a different way, right? It benefits them in some way financially from a scheduling standpoint. Otherwise, they wouldn't really do it that way. They do whatever works best from a business sense. So I can see one scenario in not giving cash per diem and doing it the way that they're doing it by covering the housing and doing these tailgate buffets and stuff like that is they can probably put all that on a credit card. And not only can they get points and things from a credit card if they're doing it right, but they get a lot of benefits from doing that, which is they don't have to pay out $10,000 in per diem in cash right away and just withdraw that from their accounts. They can just put it on credit. They can put it on a line of credit. They can do all kinds of things that are difficult to do with cash. So I understand that. But then on the other side of things, you know, where I was when I was a field technician, you know, before I started my blog and podcast and all that stuff, I really honestly, I'm almost ashamed to say this, but I honestly didn't think about archaeology that much when I got off of work. I got off of work and I went home and I did other things. I go on a bike ride, you know, it's with my wife, probably before we were married too. You know, and we would do other things. And I was like, I don't want to think about archaeology stuff after work. So having the company decide where I have to live and having the company decide what I'm going to eat and when I'm going to eat is not a level of freedom I was willing to give up. And a lot of people aren't. And I think, but then again, a lot of people are. They want to treat every single job like a field school. You know what I mean? But then again, when you're in this for long enough, people don't want to necessarily treat every job like a field school. They want to go to work and they want to come home and they want to watch Game of Thrones, have a beer and go to bed. Right. So,
well, I think we've had this argument before, but I would disagree with you on, I agree with you that, you know, like my off clock time is my off clock time. Right. And you know, as far as having them set up hotels, that means I don't have to worry about it. Yeah. And you know, this particular company is really good about, you know, they're not sticking us in the you know, rundown hotels. It's like we're getting a reasonable hotel that has a reasonable Wi-Fi, you know, and you know, usually some sort of hot breakfast buffet, and you know, if it's a cold continental breakfast, usually that's not good enough, and the, you know, permit holder will be looking for something better. You know, because they're out there too, you know. That, you know, if you don't want to go to dinner with everybody, you know, and everybody, it's like, you know, the crew sizes here are really small. It's like four people.
Right.
So, but if you don't, you are perfectly free to go out, get whatever you'd like somewhere else, and put it in for reimbursement. And reimbursement's actually pretty quick.
Well, that's good. That's a good compromise, so I think.
You can opt out. I don't know. I think they might frown upon you opting out from a hotel.
Mm-hmm.
Just on like a logistical thing.
Yeah.
You know, unless there's a hotel right across the street,
right,
then they're probably not going to do it because they're not going to want to drive across town to drop you off.
Right. Right.
You know, and we're not doing the meet you at the hotel thing. We're meeting at the office and we're all driving down together, and drive time is paid time.
Right. Okay, well, I want to bring up the hotel thing in a minute again, but let's go to break real fast, and we'll pick it up on the other side. Real quick, though, I want to mention the ad that you're about to hear. It's for PCS Videos, Professional Certifications for Scientists, and I'm bringing this up because I was just listening to the episode 6 of the Women in Archaeology podcast, where they continue their discussion on the Charlie Pliska survey from last year. And they really had a heavy discussion about certification and didn't mention PCS once. And I feel like that's all I talk about, but apparently not. So I want you to, you know, listen to this and maybe go check out the PCS website at pcscourses.com and understand what we're trying to do to this field and the future of this field based on what, you know, and you have a say in this, actually. You know, comment to us and email us and tell us how you feel about what we're doing, because this is something that helps, you know, helps everybody. So anyway, listen to this, and we'll see you on the other side of the break. Professional Certifications for Scientists, or PCS, aims to provide practical educational videos, field guides, knowledge tests, professional certifications, and deployment connections to professional scientists everywhere. Check out the videos page for high-quality training videos on a variety of topics. Find PCS videos at www.pcscourses.com/videos. PCS, a place for good scientists to become great science professionals. All right, we're back. So, you know, Stephen, one of the things you were mentioning is that you can opt out of the company meals, which is great. If you have the option, I think that's perfect. One of the things, though, is, as you said, you might not be able to opt out of the hotel. And that's, again, something people out here in the West are really passionate about. When I worked back East, it was just, that's how it worked. You know, you just expected that they were going to get your hotel for you done. That's just the way it was. And I was expecting that every single time. But when I got out West and we had the choice, and basically in the morning, and this works, people always say it doesn't work, but it does work. You know, we had a meeting point. It was usually at whatever hotel the company was staying at, like the company employees, the crew chiefs and stuff, if they were company employees or the project manager. And we would just meet there in the morning. We had people that would camp out on BLM land. We had people staying down in an RV in a trailer park. You know, we had people staying at other hotels in town because they just, you know, they just didn't want to stay at the hotel we were at. That was fine. We hired adults, right? So we expected them, and I did the same thing on my projects. I didn't care where you stayed, but if you weren't there at 7 o'clock in the morning when we were leaving, or 5 o'clock in the morning, or whatever the time was, then you simply didn't work that day. Okay, and not once did that ever happen. Not once did somebody show up late. Everybody showed up on time. And I just figured, you know, it's a freedom issue. Why are we policing that?
And you said it's a logistical issue too.
It's our job.
No other job does that. Starbucks doesn't say, well, you have to live within 5 miles of this store to work here because, you know, we don't want you to be late for work because of traffic. Nobody does that. Why do we treat our people like children? Like irresponsible children, when this isn't a field school, this is a job. This is a job that you're expected to do in a professional way. And if you don't do it in a professional way, you're fired. Okay? End of story. So I don't know. I feel pretty strongly about this. And like I said, maybe it's naive and I would feel differently after owning a business and running projects for 20 years. But I don't know. I feel like that's where a lot of the animosity from Facebook comes from, is people not being treated well. First off, people not understanding the big picture, there's that, but also people not feeling like they're being treated like, you know, like adults. Thoughts?
You know, I get the freedom thing. Like, you know, nobody wants to be like, you know, like, hey, you know, if I'm not on the clock, my time is my time, right? But some of the issue is like the logistical. Like, if we're driving down in the company truck, that's, you know, we're on the clock. If you're driving down in a personal vehicle, you're not on the clock. And that's actually a liability issue, right? You can't be on the clock from a non-company vehicle. And to a certain degree, you know, it's like, I get the freedom thing, but on the other hand, tough shit, you know, the job is we're going down there, and it's like, it is a traveling job, and most traveling jobs are kind of like that. You know, if you wanted to opt out, drive down on your own time and all that, you know, you could probably put it forward, and the permit holder would be, most of the permit holders would probably be okay with it. But on the other hand, you know, why? You know, what are you getting that you wouldn't get from, you know, a hassle-free, just kick back in the back seat and you know, there's no benefit.
Yeah, I know. It doesn't come down to logic, though. It comes down to people's sense of freedom and sense of independence, I think, is really it. Sonia, you've got some good comments. What's up?
Yeah, here's something that I've had to deal with on occasion. It's not common, but sometimes we, as a small business, sometimes we have to wait for someone if they've overslept because their alarm clock didn't go off or whatever, for whatever reason. We need to get that project completed. We have a schedule that needs to be met. For example, if we're awarded a contract that needs to be completed within 15 days and we lose someone off that project, everybody else is covering their work. And those people aren't easily replaced, especially when you're in the middle of nowhere. And how do you get somebody out there within, you know, 2 hours? You can't do it. You need to get people out, and people need to be in the field. So what I've usually done in the past is actually tell the person who is late in front of all the other people, look, you've wasted all our time. You think that you're late by, you know, 20 minutes only affects you. Well, let me tell you how much it affects us. We have 6 other people on that crew. That's 120 minutes of time that you've wasted.
Right.
That has to be billed because all these other people turned up on time. It's more than 120. It's twice that, right? Mm-hmm. I don't know. Oh, anyway, yeah. Math. Don't ask me to do it. But you know, that's a lot of time to blow just by being 20 minutes late for a meeting or for the meeting time in the morning. And that's a lot of money, and that's a lot of field work that could have been gotten done in that amount of time. It's frustrating because we can't replace people on these small projects. If we were big firms, maybe I could make a call to the main office and say, hey, so-and-so is always late, send out another guy or another 2 guys. And we're going to fire this one. It doesn't always work that way.
Right. I get that. And you know, your concerns are definitely valid. And I was in the same boat for that last project because it took 3 months to get a pass to get on the base. So if I actually did have a circumstance where I wanted to fire somebody, I mean, usually, you know, that right away, you don't have to, you know, it's like, I want to fire this person, but I don't want to wait 3 months to not only find somebody else, but get them cleared through the background checks.
And that, exactly.
I mean, that was a huge issue. I was lucky in that I didn't have that situation. I had a lot of good people working for me that I never once thought, oh, I want to replace this person, right? So that was very lucky on my point because it was a constant thought on my head. What if this goes south? Even if, you know, I have probably 50 people I can call, but I can't get them here tomorrow. You know, it's just physically not possible. Even if they lived in that town, I couldn't get them on the base for at least 2 months, right? So, and that's a huge deal. And like you said, too, it's another really good point, which is why people start getting stressed out about budgets and stuff. Another big picture item is 20 minutes doesn't mean you lost 20 minutes. If you've got 5 people standing there and you're waiting for the 6th person, that 20 minutes is multiplied by 6 and then multiplied by the billable great. And that's how much money you just lost. And
exactly,
you know, people bitch about not going to the gas station every day for snacks or something like that. And then they, you know, they stand in line and it takes a half an hour from the time you get to the gas station to the time you leave. And all that time adds up and all that time is billable. And that's a few hundred dollars that just was taken away from the project you say they don't have any money for. And yet, you know, you want to spend 30 minutes on the clock at the freaking gas station. It's just nobody looking at the big picture and everybody thinking me, and not realizing that, you know, the company is not often this big, huge, evil corporation like everybody rails against. It's usually a smaller operation run by a few people that are really trying their best. And I've heard some pretty callous remarks on Facebook about, well, that's not my concern. If you can't run a company, then don't run a company, you know, or if you can't, if you don't have the money, then get out of the business, you know, something like that. It just simply doesn't work that way.
If I'm 20 minutes late, it's no big deal. Never mind those 30 other people who are waiting on you.
Yeah, totally. Totally. It's a lot of give and take. And I think it's definitely on both sides. There's plenty of people who are running companies. And by people at running companies, I don't necessarily even mean like you or me, Sonia. I mean the face of the company that the field tech actually sees sometimes, because you might not be in the field every single time. You might have a project manager or a crew chief that is actually quote unquote the company. And I've worked for a number of companies where I never once even went to the office, met the owners or anything like that. And most of the time never even met the PI. You know, we met the field, the crew chiefs and things like that. And they were the face of the company. They're not running the show. And they probably don't even know what the budget is. You know, they just have a certain set of parameters that they have to operate within. And now you're going to bash this company because of the way they handled things. So I don't know. It's all very interesting thinking, honestly. And the way my perspective has changed from being a field technician in a number of different regions of the country, and then moving into project management, and then moving into, principal investigator and company owner. It gives you an interesting perspective on things. I will say that. And I wish everybody could have that. Like, again, another podcast I was listening to, you know, they were like, They're one offhand remark as a solution, and the fact that this was an offhand remark and not really a conscious thought was that, which is what tells me it's prevalent in people's thinking, is, oh, if you want to make more money, just own a company. That's your other solution. If you want a full time job and you want benefits and retirement and more money, own a company. That is so way out in left field that I don't even know where to start. I mean, I don't have retirement. I don't have benefits. I have benefits because I serve my country in the military. That's it. I have VA. Done. But my company's not really providing me much of anything. I mean, sure, I'll use a company credit card for different expenses I have, and use that as a tax deduction. But I'm not getting extra money necessarily for that. I'm not getting benefits and things like that. You know, other companies are different, but that's how mine operates right now. And it's just, you know, it's frustrating.
That's so true. That's so true. What a lot of these field technicians and crew chiefs and people who don't understand or don't know what goes on behind the scenes don't realize that some of us actually have taken out mortgages on our house in order to finance our business, to start it out. Some of them don't realize that that some companies have taken out hundreds of thousands of dollars in loans. That's not bad business.
Yeah.
That's starting up a business. And what happens to us if you guys are not doing your jobs correctly, then it comes back and it hits us.
Mm-hmm.
And as Chris was saying, it's not a me, the company owes me things. It's about us. And right. It's about you. It's about me. It's about the business. It's about being a good archaeologist and doing a good service to the client and to the resources.
Mm-hmm.
And from there on, you got to start thinking as a we.
Yeah.
Like it's not all about you.
So let's talk about some different ways to operate as a field technician that aren't necessarily very common. One of the things I want to mention is being a 1099 employee. You might have heard that term thrown around a little bit. And honestly, the firm that I was subcontracting for those projects last year, they expected that that's how they were going to hire people. They were going to hire me to be the field director, and they were going to 1099 a bunch of employees. Or that's basically how they were going to do it. And which means for those employees, and we'll talk about Sony's coming here in a second. Which means for those employees, they were subcontractors basically, and they were going to get paid. They would have to invoice the company at the end of the month, which is how they wanted to do it, and then they would get paid when the company paid the invoice. And their typical language for paying on projects is you get paid when we get paid, and that's common. That's not uncommon. That's incredibly common. But before we get too far into this, Sonia, you're saying 1099 is illegal for archaeologists. What do you mean by that?
Okay. First of all, the IRS has a certain setup for 1099. They're not employees. If you call it an employee, they're not a 1099 contractor.
Oh yeah.
A 1099
for sure.
Is a contractor. They are subject to the same flow down provisions as your contract, which basically means that if you have to hold $2 million in liability insurance plus another $1 million in overhead and all that other fun stuff, so does your 1099.
Right.
Additionally, the IRS has actually established some questions, and I'm currently Googling that right now, that basically says, are you a 1099 independent contractor or are you not? So one of them is, does the company control or have the right to control what the worker does or how the worker does his or her job?
Mm-hmm.
When they show up, are there written contracts with or employee benefits? Will the relationship continue or is the work performed as an aspect of the business? What types of business aspects of the worker's job are controlled by the company? So basically that means if I hire someone to go out and do an archaeological survey, I am controlling what that archaeologist is doing. If I am saying you must show up at 8 a.m. and you must work until 5 p.m., I am controlling, I as the business, am controlling what you're doing. That means you cannot be a 1099 contractor.
All right, let's pause right there. So, you know, I was essentially a 1099 company for that last project, right? Because I was their subcontractor hired to do the field work. But they told us when to start the field work. They told us based on the basis requirements, basically when we could work. It wasn't exactly start at 7 a.m. It was, you know, but you're going to work Tuesday through the following Thursday and you're going to work 8 hours a day. Where is the line right there? Does that count or
you,
what?
You are your own business, right? Did you submit your 1099 form and then also also your insurance certificates?
Yes, I did.
Your carrier, then you're a 1099 contractor.
Right. Well, that's what I'm talking about on an individual basis.
As individuals, they must carry the same level of insurance as the contract requires. And that's not like health insurance. That's liability. That's errors and omissions. That's umbrella policies, if applicable.
Oh yeah, I pay $3,000 a year in insurance, so I know what you're talking about.
Easily. So if that individual carries their own liability, errors and omissions, and all that other stuff, they can be a 1099 contractor. That's no big deal. But if they don't carry all that insurance and all that on all those other things, they're considered employees.
So let's talk hypotheticals then, because I've heard this batted around before in conversations. Let's say I've got a project coming up, okay, and I don't want to hire any quote unquote employees. I want everybody to be 1099. Can I hire a 1099 crew chief and a 1099, you know, three field technicians, and they're all got their own insurance? They're all covered under the project. They all have the insurance that meets the project's needs. They're all invoicing me at the end of the month, and yet the employees are coming to work when the crew chief tells them to come to work, and I'm telling the crew chief, hey, you need to get this project done in the next month, and I don't care when you do it, but the client says you can only work these days. So is that even theoretically possible in that situation?
Theoretically, it's possible if your crew chief and your field techs want to fork over the $3,500 to $7,000 a year mm-hmm. in insurance costs.
Right.
So theoretically, yes, it is possible. And yes, it is legal. But if you are paying your employees or these 1099s that you say don't have their own insurance and are covered by insurance, they're not.
Okay.
And if something were to happen to those guys on your project, you're going to get sued.
Right, right. Well, and there's other issues with that, too.
I urge caution with that.
Right. Well, I want to talk about a little more about the benefits and some more of the disadvantages to doing that, because people talk about this a lot as an option, and I want to dispel the rumors on that. Plus, Doug has some comments, but let's go to the break real quick, and we'll come back and finish this up with a slightly longer segment. Here's another one of our business tips from Christopher Doerr at Heritage Business International. Back in a second.
Hi, everyone. This is Christopher Doerr with Heritage Business International, and here is this week's Heritage Business Tip from the archive. This week, we look at authority. One of the largest obstacles holding back heritage organization growth is centralized authority. If you are a heritage executive, push true decision-making authority as deep as you can into your organization. To be successful, though, you must give your staff clear goals, the training and resources they need to be successful, and then hold them accountable for their performance. The best heritage CEOs are listeners, coordinators, and facilitators, not decision makers. To receive our most up-to-date heritage business tips, you can subscribe to our free weekly email at heritagebusiness.org. Until next time, this is Christopher Doerr.
All right, we're back, and we're going to continue this discussion of contract employees. Doug, you've got some comments.
Yeah, this is something that also occurs in the UK as well, and I think most places, is that every once in a while, a company will sort of look at it, and sometimes it's actually really small companies, so maybe, you know, a one-man band suddenly got a very big contract, and they just don't have the infrastructure to be able to handle employees. So essentially a call goes out for people to be self-employed, to be, you know, independent contractor, not an employee. And I just urge a lot of caution to anyone who picks up such work. There are lots of implications that people don't think about. One is all they do is they look at the amount of money and they're like, oh, wow. This is why I calculate this out. This is, you know, $30 or $40 an hour. Oh, this is excellent. I'll be making more money than if I was an employee. But you need to consider you'll have to pay taxes.
Yeah.
You'll have to file that in your taxes. You'll have to, I know we've been talking about this, insurance. You need to figure out if you're insured or not. And overheads. Like most people, when you're going from being, you know, an employee to essentially self-employed or, you know, running your own company, you need to start thinking about overheads. And overheads are things like insurance. But it's also things like equipment, because, you know, if you are, you know, self-employed or a contractor, you're not an employee, then in most cases, unless you get written into the contract, they don't have to provide you with any equipment. So suddenly, you know, if you're like, oh, hey, I'll just show up. And then they're like, well, where's your shovel? Where's your trowel? I mean, yes, most of us have kit like that. But if you need something bigger, you might need to provide that. You might need to be looking at, you know, paper, pen, all these different things that you sort of, you know, minor little costs, but they actually add up a lot really quick. And so I just say, like, be really, really careful, because everyone looks at just a large number of money, the top dollar, and they're thinking, oh, this is great, I'm making money. But then once you put in your expenses, it costs a lot. And like in America, you're going to be having to pay Social Security, in the UK, national insurance. So, you know, that's getting taken out as well. For people who don't know, that's basically the same thing, just different name. It's your sort of state pension based, you know, hopefully, you know, and some years you'll be able to take it. But all these different costs kick in, and if you're self-employed, you have to be really, really careful, especially when it comes to taxes. You could actually end up making a lot less money when you suddenly calculate in how much you have to take out for taxes, Social Security, national insurance, you know, any sort of workman's comp insurance, anything like that. And actually, it turns out you could actually be making less money than if you were an employee. So just a word of warning.
Yeah, no, that's something good to bring up too, because you know, if you're going to be a 1099 employee for somebody, you're going to do all the same things that any other subcontractor would do, which means you just don't show up for work one day and expect a paycheck at the end of the month. You you write a proposal and you say, this is what my costs are going to be, my hourly rate. And that's, it's got to be something that covers, like you said, you need to factor in, you know, the way we're getting into different territory now, the way companies factor in their billable rates is they say, okay, what am I paying in insurance every year? What are my vehicle costs per year? What are my, travel expenses? What are my, you know, do I have an office? Do I have computer equipment? Do I have all this other stuff? What are these, indirect expenses that, you know, they can't directly bill for, but that I still have to cover every year, including my taxes, your taxes at the end of the year, whether you have state taxes and or federal taxes or whatever taxes your country has. So you factor all that stuff in and then you basically divide that out by the number of hours in the year. Let's say, assuming you're working 40 hours a week for 52 weeks a year or 50 weeks a year, whatever it is, 52 if your vacation is paid. And then that's your overhead, basically. Then you say, okay, how much money do I want to make? What's my take home? What's my hourly that I want to get? You know, then you start factoring all those numbers in and you come up with this billable number per hour that covers all those overhead expenses. It covers your per diem and it covers your hourly rate. It covers all of that because nobody else is giving you that money. Okay. And if you don't come up with a number that covers all those bases, well, you're going to be screwed by the end of the year and you are not going to make any money.
And usually almost every time I've ever seen one of these self-employed sort of, you know, contractor 1099, or in the UK we just call it self-employed, anytime I've ever seen it, they've already set that rate. They just say, you know, we're paying you this much per day or per hour. That's it. So you don't actually even get to say, there's usually no negotiation. I've never seen it. Maybe it occurs. Mm-hmm. I don't want to do a blanket statement, but I've never seen where people can say, actually, I'm billing you this amount because this is what I cost. They usually just say, you know, we're going to pay you X amount and you're going to be self-employed, you know, your own contract employee.
Right.
And you sort of have to figure that out on your own. And I've seen sometimes where it works out really nice. And those are usually pretty good companies. And I've seen sometimes where people jump into that and realize that they're making minimum wage or below minimum wage when they calculate in all their expenses.
You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. Whether you are a business, or if you are an independent contractor, or if you are an employee who's thinking about coming on as a 1099, and you live in the United States or are subject to U.S. law, I would suggest that you go onto the Google and search for IRS independent contractor employee. And go over the common law rules, their behavioral, financial, and then the type of relationship, and really ask yourself, is this employee or am I doing what the company wants me to do or doing what I want to do? And consider that before you ever accept or offer a 1099 job. Just make sure you're in compliance with the law. Additionally, honestly, you could say, I'm going to charge the company $30 to $40 an hour, and realistically, you're going to be making $10 an hour. After all those taxes, all your self-employment taxes, you have to pay all of your insurance, everything, you're going to be making less than what you think you are. So in general, I just say, don't do the 1099 thing. It's just not good practice.
And again, look at the big picture, though. Somebody, let's just say $10 an hour is what you end up taking home. You have to think, you know, when you normally think working a job and I'm going to take home $10 an hour, you think, ah, Christ, I've got to pay for my car payment, my car insurance, my rent. I've got to cover my food and all that stuff with that $10 an hour. That's what a normal person thinks. But if you're a subcontractor and you're doing it right, you're covering a portion of your rent because you have a workspace or an office or a gear storage in your house or something like that. So you're covering a portion of your rent and your utilities. You're covering your car when it's being used for work. You're covering your car insurance when it's being used for work. You have to take percentages on some of this stuff if it's not 100% used for work. So, but so $10 an hour for somebody who's possibly, you know, maybe single, doesn't have a family, likes doing this, that might actually be good, because you're, that other $8, $9 an hour you might be getting as a field tech is actually being taken off of your, you know, your expenses and your taxes, and it's being covered by your quote unquote business expenses. So I'm just speaking hypothetically here and kind of looking at the big picture and all the numbers.
Here's the thing though, when you're talking about insurance, like your medical insurance, that's not included in the type of insurance I'm talking about.
Oh,
I'm
no.
talking about your liability insurance, your auto insurance, your professional errors and omissions, any umbrellas, all of that sort of stuff. When a company pays for that, and say for example, for me, it's somewhere around $7,000 to $7,500 a year. But I'm structured differently than you are, Chris. When we pay for that, that is shared. That $7,500 is shared amongst all the billing rates for all of my employees and throughout the year. But when you're paying $3,500 to $7,500 annually for that type of insurance to carry it, you're covering the cost. You're on your own. So those costs do add up when you're not sharing them among other employees.
Right.
And I honestly really caution people with this 1099 thing. And I've had clients asking me the same question. Well, why don't you just 1099? We mm-hmm. used to do that all the time. Well, it's because the IRS has now some very specific rules. And if you get caught, both you and the company that you worked for are going to be in trouble.
Right.
And I can guarantee you that your company probably has better lawyers than you do.
Yeah, probably. So let's shift gears just a little bit here. Although not really, because it's all tied to each other. It's all related. Another comment that we see frequently on Facebook these days is that there's the perceived slowdown in work this year. And while that may or may not be true, it really depends on where you're at and where you're working. Some places have more work than others. I mean, that's just the nature of business. It's not going to be. It can be nationwide as an overall trending curve based on things that are happening with our economy. But in general, you're only going to be affected by your little micro area where you tend to base out. But I don't want to really talk about that because there's nothing we can really do about that, which is something field techs need to hear. There's nothing we can really do about that. I can't go out and just generate more work, right? I mean, I can write proposals, but if they're not there, they're not there. I can do all kinds of things, but, you know, it's just really out of my hands on how much work is out there. Now it's in my hands on how much work I can win. So I can try to get to, you know, different things in, but it's out of my hands on how much work is out there. So, but I want to talk about, some of the other comments I've heard and some of the other big picture stuff, but, go ahead, Doug.
Well, I'm just going to stir the pot a little bit and say you can't control what's going on with development work, but I'm pretty sure at some point Chris Dorr is going to give a one of those nice little helpful hints to say diversify.
Yes.
So a lot of people definitely have, you know, very specific things, and even companies within CRM. I mean, there are companies who just do a very specific type of project. Maybe it's just cell towers or, you know, road work. I mean, there's some people who do very, very specific work. And if that work dries up, yes. And you can't usually control that. But you can also diversify away and definitely aim to do different sorts of jobs. And I am a slightly disagree with the whole idea that field techs can't control that outcome. So I'm going to say, in practice, yes. In theory, no. Because basically, so right now, we have an employee. So I'm a director of a company. Mm-hmm. And, it's you know, it's a couple of us and we don't work full time. So I have two jobs. I have one as a director of a company that I help manage projects on, and one where I do another full time job. And so I actually don't really sleep. But basically we have a guy and we have him on projects and he's really good, and we desperately want to keep him on, but we can only at this moment keep him on at two-thirds, you know, he's only two-thirds of the salary. Well, you know, so he works, you know, like 3 days a week for us. And he has a second job working in a bar. And, you know, so he's fine enough on money and stuff, but we really want to keep him on and get him there. And so as part of that, we're teaching him how to write proposals. We're teaching him how to go out and find how we find tenders, and getting him to write tenders so he can basically find his own work and get projects so he can be full time. And I know very few companies ever do this. Usually it's so hierarchy that basically, you know, as a field tech, you dig, that's all you do. And then nothing else. And then as you move up, you might write reports. But you know, honestly, unless you're a small company in which you do everything, a lot of them have sort of started breaking up everything. So, you know, if you're in the lab, all you do is do lab stuff. If you're in the office, all you do is office stuff. If you're right. Tech, all you do is dig, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, companies, and especially smaller ones, are interested in people who will go out and get work. I think if archaeology did a little more training of people about how to do projects, and I know why people don't do it. They're afraid that as soon as they teach someone how to get projects, they're going to suddenly start their own company and then undercut you later in life, and you're going to lose projects to the person that you've trained up, blah, blah, blah. But a lot of people actually don't want to deal with the hassle. I think the audience, at least us speakers, you know, all of us have, you know, directors or high up in a company or something like that, realize that there's a lot of paperwork. And some people just want to do projects. And so if you train someone that you find projects, they'll find projects, they'll do it, they'll not necessarily go out and then become your competitor. But I do think archaeology, especially in CRM, should branch out and start training people to look at different projects, and not necessarily archaeology related. I mean, we're in cultural resource management, so that's much broader area. We can do a lot of ethnographic work. You can do stuff like that. You can work with, you know, tribal groups in the United States. There's a lot of different things that you can do as an archaeologist. I'm sorry I'm rambling on here, but I'm just saying, I think there's a slowdown in certain specific types of work. And if you're willing to diversify, that doesn't mean there's a slowdown in your work.
Yeah, I always stay busy and it's never with the same thing. So, you know, there's that.
Also, like, field tech, don't wait for your company to do it. Ask them if you can go out and find work and take some training, take some courses, figure out a way that you could do it as well. So definitely try to pick up those skills.
So I agree with Doug wholeheartedly. Diversify. If you work for a company that has more than just archaeology, go over to that biology department or that NEPA department or that geotechnical department and say, hey, I'm running low on work. What can I do to help you? These are my skills. And is there any training that I can take to maybe go out and help you monitor for prairie dogs or sage grouse or whatever, black-footed ferrets? You know, diversify your skills, make yourself more valuable to the company. And last but not least, make sure you watch your attitude. Stay positive. I know it's hard. I've been there. We've all been there.
Yeah.
Your attitude will spread. So if you stay positive, people will stay positive. If you get really negative, then honestly, your bosses are probably going to be looking at you to be the first one to go, because this is hard not only for you, but it's hard for them, because they know that this is a challenging time. They are working very hard to keep you employed.
Right.
So stay positive. And if you do get laid off, it's not the end of the world. There's something good out there for you.
Yeah. And this is just sort of touching on a pet peeve, but Sonia brought it up, a very good point there. So I know a lot of people have been told over the years, do GIS, it'll get you a good archaeology job. Well, one, that's completely BS. There's not that many GIS archaeology jobs. and there's so many people that have done GIS that you haven't gained any skill that half your company probably has. But GIS is something that's transferable to other departments. So you can use that skill over in, as Sonia was saying, you know, biology. They still need to, that's something that, you know, does spatial work or even planning. People, you know, they're doing that and they're planning out their roads or their construction, stuff like that. That requires spatial work as well. So a skill like GIS is not going to get you a good archaeology job, but it can help you diversify out so that you end up, you know, working during those downtimes when there isn't archaeology in your company. Or actually, I tend to know a lot of archaeologists who've managed to move out of archaeology, and GIS is the way they do it because they basically get a higher paying job doing GIS in a different area. But it is sort of those skills that can be worked across in different areas. And if you're in a big enough company, you can move across. Or if you're even in a small company, you can be hired out. So if you have a specialty like, you know, bones or something, and there's not anyone else in your area, and another company gets the work, you know, they might, you know, subcontract you out to that company. So, yeah, look at diversifying your skill set.
Right. All right. Well, we're out of time. As usual, there's a lot more we could talk about on this, and maybe we'll pick this up at our next recording. But one of the things I just want to mention right here in the last 20 seconds is I have seen other comments where on similar topics to this, where people say, well, if I were an engineer or a plumber or, you know, insert job here, why do I have to make, you know, sacrifices? Why I wouldn't have to do, you know, figure out what works or diversify or do something like that. I was like, true. You know, if you want to do that, then go back to school or go to a trade school and be one of those things. But the simple fact is, if you want to be an archaeologist, a contract archaeologist in the United States, there's a slim chance you can get a permanent job. I mean, they are out there. Owning a business is not the answer to that equation for everybody. I'll just put that out there too. Not everybody can or wants to do it or realizes what's even involved. But if you want to, I mean, quite frankly, if you want to have a family, if you want to have a 9-to-5 and a Monday through Friday job, it's going to be very difficult, not impossible, but very difficult to do that in archaeology. And I don't want to, you know, disillusion anybody, but, you know, if you want that, you can find it, but you have to be willing to move. I mean, look at the healthcare industry. Who goes to med school and then stays where they were and then, you know, just works there at a hospital? But probably nobody. You know, they'll move across the country to go do their residency somewhere and then go to here and then go to there. And then they'll get their family. They'll you know, or they'll bring their family along with them, and then they'll end up somewhere. I mean, that's pretty common. It's really no different with archaeology. If you want a permanent job and mostly 9-to-5 and not be out of town very much, you're going to need an advanced degree, and you're going to need to stay somewhere that actually has that work, and you're going to have to go find it and then make your life in that location. But if you're not willing to make those concessions, then, you know, it's going to be difficult. So, but then again, there's people that love traveling around and just being, you know, independent and doing what they're going to do. So
can I just add one positive last take?
Very
10
quick.
Seconds.
Very quick.
Diversifying is a lot of fun as well. Doing different projects and not doing the same old thing day in and day out is a lot of fun. So I know we're saying this is like, you know, you're going to have to diversify, but also look at it as, yes, you get to diversify and do many different things that can be quite challenging intellectually and quite fun.
Yeah, and I'll plug one last thing too. If you want to help out or try to help out with the APN or with PCS, the aforementioned PCS, these two projects are on the verge of possibly getting some fairly serious funding where we could actually pay for some of the services that we need in the background. We can't now, don't get me wrong. You would be getting in on the ground floor of something that really just cost you time. But it is fun, and it is diversifying, and it is potentially going to pay out here shortly. So, you know, not to be too cryptic about that, but the details are sketchy. So anyway, that's it for this week. Thanks a lot, everybody, and we'll see you next time. That's it for another episode of the CRM Archaeology Podcast. Links to some of the items mentioned on the show are in the show notes for this podcast, which can be found at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/CRM Arc Podcast. If you like the show and want to comment, please do. You can leave comments about this or any other episode on the website or on the iTunes page for the episode. You can also email me at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com or use the contact form on the podcast webpage. If you'd like us to answer a question on a future episode, email us. Use the contact form on the website or tweet your questions with the hashtag CRMArcPodcast, or you can tag @ArcPodNet in your tweet. Please share the link to the show wherever you saw it. If you share CRM archaeology-related items on Twitter or Facebook or anywhere else for that matter, be sure to use the hashtag CRMARC so the community can see and comment. If you'd like to subscribe to this podcast, you can do so on iTunes or on Stitcher Radio. You can also type the name of the podcast into your favorite podcasting app and subscribe that way. Don't forget to go over to iTunes and leave a review of the show. It helps us get noticed so more people can find our podcast and benefit from the content. Also, send us show suggestions and interview suggestions. We want this to be a resource for field technicians everywhere, and we want to know what you want to know about. Also, please consider donating to the Archaeology Podcast Network. Your donations help fund our bandwidth and contribute to our editing costs. Thanks to everyone for joining me this week. Thanks also to the listeners for tuning in, and we'll see you in the field. Goodbye.
See ya.
Bye. Peace.
This show is produced by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle and was edited by Chris Webster.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.
Thanks again for listening to this episode and for supporting the Archaeology Podcast Network. If you want these shows to keep going, consider becoming a member for just $7.99 US dollars a month. That's cheaper than a venti quad eggnog latte. Go to arcpodnet.com/members for more info.